Welcome to episode 48 of the Neural Network. Today, we're going to embark on an expedition not just to the mountains, but to the very essence of our biology and endurance at great heights. So I guess today we're going to, voyage into the clouds, the realm where the air thins and the stars seem close enough to touch. But as any seasoned mountaineer will tell you, along with the breathtaking views comes a less welcome companion, and that is troubled sleep. That's right, today we're going to dive into how sleep is affected at high altitudes, a topic that anyone who's traded their sea-level bed for a sleeping bag on a rocky ledge will find eerily familiar. All right, so it's been like a month since we've had an episode, but hey, life happens. Just got back from the American Physiological Society conference in LA. There's a couple of different conferences that we go to every year, typically. One of those is the American Physiological Society conference, which was used to be known as Experimental Biology. That tends to be my favorite conference of the year. I find that I enjoy the topics of science that are presented there, and also the people that are there are amazing. There's a couple other conferences that we go to every year, being Society for Neuroscience Conference, which is also an amazing conference, but it's like 10x the size of the American Physiological Society, so sometimes it can be a bit overwhelming if you're not prepared. So for anyone going to Society for Neuroscience Conference, be prepared before you get there, because you got to have a game plan. Otherwise, there's too much stuff going on at the same time. And then we also have the Oxford Conference in the Control of Breathing, which is a more select focused group of researchers that focus in primarily on the neural control of breathing itself and how our brain and our brainstems generate the rhythms that make us breathe. So those are, you know, the three conferences typically that we go to every year where we can discuss new science within the realm of the control of breathing. So just got back from that amazing conference. And so now we're back on the microphone to record an episode. So for this episode, I was looking through the Journal of Physiology. For anyone that's familiar, I tend to love the Journal of Physiology, and I have a couple of my papers published there as well. But one of the papers that I was going through that struck me was something called The Effects of Periodic Breathing on Sleep at High Altitude, a randomized placebo-controlled crossover study using inspiratory CO2. First author was Abubakar Ibrahim. I may have butchered that, and senior author of Christoph Siebmann, and that is from the University of Innsbruck in Austria, as well as Institute of Mountain Emergency Medicine in Bolzano, Italy, and the Department of Respiratory Medicine at the University Hospital of Zurich in Switzerland, so primarily a European group. And I thought that it was a great study, and so I wanted to cover it on here and talk about something that we've talked about in the past, which is environmental physiology or high altitude physiology, which is something that's quite fascinating, at least to me with my background. And really, when you go up into high altitude, it puts an enormous amount of stress on your physiology. And of course, anyone that's been at altitude before knows that when you're climbing up a flight of stairs, it may not be the easiest thing compared to when you're doing that at sea level. And there's certainly a few groups that are around the world that are specialized in studying that. Of course, in one of our earlier episodes about a year ago, we had on Dr. Trevor Day from Mount Royal University in Canada, and his group does some amazing things where they actually strap the whole physiology lab to their backs and climb up Mount Everest to base camp and study how we adapt to high altitude physiology and look at things like acid-base balance and stuff like that. And so I find this topic to be absolutely fascinating, in my opinion. So with that, let's actually talk about the paper itself. And first, let's paint a picture. All right, it's the dead of night. You're camped out on the side of an imposing peak. The wind howls outside, but inside your tent, it's silent. You should be exhausted after climbing up a mountain, but here you are, eyes wide open, staring at a nylon ceiling of the tent. Every few minutes, though, just as you feel the tug of sleep, you find yourself waking up with a start, gasping for air like a fish out of water. But why does this happen? And that's what this paper was trying to look at, and look at ways to mitigate some of those effects. But first, before that, a quick story. I got this from a friend that goes up and does high altitude climbing and stuff like that. He wrote to me. He said, "I once joined a friend on a trek to the and Apuras in Nepal. As we ascended past the 4,000 meter mark, my usually chatty friend went quiet. I found him that night, not silently contemplating the meaning of life, but rather snoring, or so I thought. Every couple of minutes, he would stop breathing entirely, then suddenly gasp for air and mumble about yetis. He blamed the altitude for his poor sleep, but perhaps he was also dreaming of mythical mountain creatures. So that was kind of an interesting thing when I asked him about what the trek up to the Annapurna was like. And so that was one of the things that stood out to him. And so this phenomenon, of course, which he observed in his friend, was what scientists tend to call nocturnal periodic breathing, or NPB for short. It's quite common at high altitudes, and it's more than just a quirky sleeping habit. It can signify impact of the quality of rest. It can significantly, I should say, impact the quality of rest that you get, affecting everything from your mood to your alertness and even your overall health during such extreme endeavors. So in this episode, we're going to talk about the paper that I mentioned that was diving into this, examining how periodic breathing at high altitudes affects sleep and what can potentially be done about it. So, of course, like any episode, it's not just for the mountain climbers among us. It is crucial information for anyone that's interested in how our human bodies adapt, or sometimes, I should say, struggle to adapt to extreme conditions. All right, so now that we've set up camp at the base of our topic, let's start by understanding the terrain. What exactly do we mean by high altitude, and why does it have such profound effects on the human body? Well, high altitude typically refers to any elevation above 2,400 meters, which is roughly 8,000 feet above sea level. So it's pretty high up there. Our Mile High Stadium is like a little over 5,000 feet, so it's way higher than that. But as you climb higher, especially above 3,500 meters, the air tends to get exponentially thinner with every step. And it isn't just a matter of feeling a bit short of breath. The higher you go, the less oxygen is available in the air. And this is pretty widely known across everybody. And the scarcity of oxygen has, of course, tangible impacts on our physiology. Now, just for a little trivia, one of the things that I like to do to ask students sometimes just to get a picture of how gases are handled within the respiratory system, you know, in normal atmospheric oxygen or normal atmospheric composition of gases, you have about 21% oxygen, 79% nitrogen, and negligible amounts of CO2 and other gases. And when you go up to high altitude, we're often told that we have less oxygen, and that's true, that there's less oxygen available. And so sometimes I'll ask the students, okay, you climb up to the top of the mountain, how much oxygen is there? What percentage of oxygen is within the atmosphere if at sea level there's 21% oxygen, 79% nitrogen? And the typical answer is usually that there's, you know, 15% oxygen or 10% oxygen, and that's not the case. There's still 21% oxygen when you go up to the top of a mountain. The trick, though, is that the total amount of pressure of all of the gases within the atmosphere is less. And so under normal conditions and sea level, there's about 760 millimeters of mercury for the total atmospheric pressure. 21% of that is oxygen. So the total pressure of oxygen is about 160 millimeters of mercury. Now, when you go up to the top of Mount Everest, for example, which is 29,000 feet, the total atmospheric pressure drops to 250 millimeters of mercury, roughly. And so 21% of 250 millimeters of mercury, now the total pressure of oxygen in the atmosphere is only 53 millimeters of mercury. And so you can see, even though that there's 21% oxygen at sea level and 21% of oxygen at the top of Mount Everest, the total amount of oxygen that's actually available to be breathed is about one-third at the top of Mount Everest compared to at sea level. And so even though it's the same, even though the percentage of oxygen is the same, it's significantly lower. All right, so the low oxygen then brings us to the next topic, which is that of hypoxia. So anytime that there's a low amount of oxygen within the body, either within all of the body or just specific compartments of the body, we tend to call this hypoxia, hypo, low, oxia, oxygen, so hypoxia. And so it's a condition, like I said, where parts of the body or the whole body is deprived of adequate oxygen supply at the tissue level. And it's not something to be taken lightly. Of course, you can see it when patients have cyanosis or they start to turn blue. That's usually from a lack of oxygen. So hypoxia then can affect everything from your muscular strength and coordination to your decision-making abilities. It can make you dizzy, cause headaches, lead to swelling, and of course, like we're going to talk about, even alter your sleep patterns. But why then does sleep actually become a casualty at high altitudes? And to answer this, we need to dive into the concept of periodic breathing. And so periodic breathing is a pattern of breathing where the depth and the rate of breathing vary cyclically, typically increasing gradually, then decreasing, and occasionally pausing entirely. So it's a waxing and waning interspersed in between apneas or just complete loss of breathing altogether. Now, at high altitudes, this erratic breathing pattern often happens during sleep. And why does it happen? So scientifically, it's linked to how our bodies respond to low oxygen. At altitude, when oxygen levels drop, our bodies increase breathing depth and rate in order to compensate, in order to try to keep your body within its homeostatic range of oxygen. However, when you start to increase your breathing, it leads to an over-exhalation of CO2. Because remember, every time you breathe in oxygen. Every time you breathe out the CO2. And because you're breathing off CO2, it of course then causes a reactive drop in breathing until your CO2 levels rise back to a trigger point. And so the cycle can repeat throughout the night, disrupting sleep, causing the sleep to oscillate between states of near wakefulness and shallow sleep. And so it has to do with something that's called loop gain. And so loop gain essentially is the measure of how a system responds to disturbances. In the context of breathing, it refers to how the respiratory control system, which includes the brain, the lungs, and the blood gases, responds to changes or errors in blood gas levels, either oxygen or carbon dioxide. So typically, breathing is regulated by a feedback loop. Sensors in the body detect levels of oxygen and carbon dioxide in the blood. If CO2 levels are too high, the brain signals the respiratory muscles to increase breathing in order to expel more CO2. Similarly, if oxygen levels are too low, the body responds by trying to increase oxygen intake. High loop gain in the respiratory system then means that the body reacts very strongly to even small deviations in CO2 or oxygen levels. And so this can lead to overcompensation. For example, if the body reduces CO2 too much, it can temporarily suppress the drive to breathe until your CO2 levels start to rise again, which leads to a pattern of unstable breathing that can, of course, manifest as this periodic breathing. Now, at high altitudes, the reduced oxygen levels can cause the body to over-respond, leading to fluctuations in the breathing pattern. So high loop gain can make these fluctuations even more pronounced, resulting in periodic breathing during sleep, and which is, of course, characterized by these cycles of deep breathing followed by apneas or hypopneas, which is reduced breathing. So, of course, understanding loop gain is very important, you know, in treating conditions like sleep apnea, where the stability of the respiratory control system is disrupted, and therapies may aim to actually modify the responsiveness or gain of the loop, such as through the use of CPAP or in order to stabilize the airway and breathing patterns during sleep. So putting it all together, you go up to high altitude. As a result, the oxygen starts to lower. As a result of the lowered oxygen, you start to breathe more. Because you start to breathe more, you breathe off your CO2. That CO2 reduces your drive to breathe. And then you stop breathing until then, of course, your CO2 levels start to rise to a point where you start to actually breathe again. And so this goes on and on and on throughout the night. And you start to have these periods where you're breathing a lot, and then you stop breathing, and then you're breathing a lot, and you stop breathing, and you get the idea. All right, so having scaled the basics of high altitude and its effects on our bodies, there's many reviews that have been written on high altitude physiology that are fascinating. You should take a look. It's time to equip ourselves with the tools of science and delve into the heart of the paper that we're examining. So the study that we're looking at was crafted to answer a compelling question. Can we improve sleep at high altitudes by manipulating the air that we breathe? To find out, the researchers did is they designed an experiment with very specific setup and method known as a randomized placebo-controlled crossover design. So to unpack that, in a crossover design, each participant experiences every condition of the experiment. So in this case, it means that each volunteer spent time sleeping in two different air compositions. This method is, of course, powerful because it allows each person to serve as their own control, which helps reduce the variability in the study and how different people might react to high altitude. And of course, it's placebo-controlled, so what about the placebo? Of course, in any medical studies, anyone unfamiliar with placebo is a treatment that has no therapeutic effect. It's used as a control in testing new drugs. Now, of course, there's many papers and podcasts and stuff about the placebo effect of drugs where you can give someone a sugar pill and, you know, they will still have a physiological effect because, of course, as we've learned throughout this podcast, the mind is a very powerful thing. So there is a such thing as a placebo effect. But nonetheless, if you want to test the effect of a drug or a treatment, you usually have to have a placebo control in order to understand whether the effect is from the drug itself or the treatment itself versus that of just the subject thinking that they are being treated. So here, of course, now it refers to the normal unaltered air composition at simulated altitude against which the effects of increased CO2 can be measured. So essentially, it helps to ensure that any changes observed are truly due to the intervention and not just the psychological effects or other external factors. Now, the setting for the study was a quite ambitious exploration. They used a hypobaric chamber, which is a room where we can simulate the atmospheric conditions at different altitudes, all while controlling other variables like temperature, humidity, etc. And so for the case of this study, the chamber was set to mimic the conditions that are found at 4,000 meters above sea level, where the air is extremely thin. So inside the chamber, the participants were tucked into their sleeping setups, but with a little bit of a twist, over different nights, they either breathed air with varying levels of CO2. And so one night, the air was normal, sort of akin to what you would find at that altitude at 4,000 meters. And then another night, the air contained a slightly increased amount of CO2. This adjustment was aimed at examining how a boost in the CO2 levels could counteract periodic breathing patterns typically induced by high altitude. And it's quite an ingenious little test that they put together, right? Because when we were talking about the mechanism of periodic breathing at high altitude, of course, one of the main mechanisms is that due to the hypoxia, you start to breathe more. As a result, you breathe off your CO2. Your CO2 gets too low. It stops you from breathing. And so the essentially asking the question, can we just pipe in a little bit of CO2 to make sure it doesn't reach that threshold and it keeps you actually breathing? Now, anyone that's familiar with high CO2 research, of course, the beginning of my scientific journey was all about studying the effects of high CO2 rather than here talking about low oxygen. Knows that, you know, piping in CO2 isn't, there's no free lunch. You know, we can't just necessarily pipe in CO2 and expect that there's no deleterious effects of that as well. But, you know, when we're talking about doing physiology at high altitude and trying to keep people from this periodic breathing pattern, which can lead to many deleterious effects as you're climbing, it starts to become a balance of what's better, you know, breathing a little bit of CO2 to keep you from not having periodic breathing versus the effects of just having periodic breathing. And so the amount of CO2 that they were using wasn't a huge amount. I mean, it was, I think they had about 1.7% CO2 that was piped in. And so, yeah, 1.76% CO2 was piped in. And you know, that's not a negligible amount of CO2. Of course, in a normal human, the ventilatory response to CO2 is roughly around 3 or so, which that just means that for every increase in every 1 millimeter of mercury increase in CO2, there tends to be about a 3 liter per minute increase in breathing. And so for the case of this study, let's just say if you're, I don't know, you know, typically, but that's under awake conditions, which is sort of a caveat of this. And so what we'll actually find in the results of the study is that the breathing rate from the increased CO2 actually wasn't changed. And so it seems kind of counterintuitive because, you know, 1.7% increase in CO2 would typically increase the pressure of CO2 within your blood quite substantially, which would lead you to breathe a lot more than you would prior. But since they're sleeping, it reduces some of the sensitivity to CO2 and they're already at hypoxia. And so nonetheless, as a result, they didn't have a huge increase in breathing from the CO2, which, again, like I said, was interesting to see, but certainly these subjects are not under normal conditions, so it's not all that unexpected. And of course, throughout the study, you know, they were in this hypobaric chamber, which is simulating the altitude, and they had 3 nights of sleep originally, then there was a 4-week washout, and then they did 3 nights again. So they, you know, it was hats off to the researchers that found these subjects that were willing to stay in a hypobaric chamber for, you know, a total of 6 nights, because they, you know, they're not allowed to leave, and so you're in there for 3 days, so you gotta, you know, try to keep them entertained throughout that. And so I know at least for us, I'm not sure you could find any Amazon gift cards, which are a favorite amongst rewards for subjects, that would be able to get a good amount of people that are willing to do that. But they were able to find 12 people that were actually willing to go under the protocol. And so during the nights, they were set with polysomnography. They had their head tents on in order to change the amount of CO2 that they were breathing. They also measured the they measured the CO2 that was piped into the head tents, and they also measured end-tidal CO2, so the amount of CO2 that was being breathed off. They also measured their breathing through things that were set up, and it was kind of interesting looking at the study. They had a picture of the setup, which was kind of cool, but they actually used a weighted blanket as well in order to reduce the amount of air that was escaping between the body. So you have someone that's laying in the bed, and they have this, you know, this tent essentially over their head, and then they had blanket because they were sleeping. But because you can't make the thing completely airtight, which, you know, introduces variability, you have to try to make it as airtight as you can. And one of the places where there's a lot of air escape is if you make the tent sort of continuous with the blanket, there's, you know, dead space, or there's room in between where your body is just lifting up the blanket. And so they used sort of these weighted blankets that form around you in order to reduce the amount of air that was around the body, which I thought that was kind of cool, just from a, you know, experimental perspective. Okay, so like I said, they took the subjects, they put them in a hyperbaric chamber for 3 nights, measured all their breathing stuff, measured their sleeping stuff, and then they had a 4-week period where they were given just, you know, where they weren't in the box anymore, just living their normal lives. And then they came back, and then they did another 3 nights, and they split them up into 2 groups. And for some of the subjects on the first 3 nights, they were given room air to breathe during their sleep. And then in their second 3 nights, they were given the CO2. And vice versa. There was another group that in their first time, their first 3 nights that they were there, they were given the CO2. And the second 3 nights that they were there, they were given room air. And of course, it's blinded, so the subjects themselves did not know the composition of air within their head tents that they were breathing while they were sleeping. And then, like I said, they measured all their respiratory and EEG values for sleep as well. So when it comes to the results are presented in a lot of tables, which is sort of classic for these kinds of studies, and so I figure we can just walk through them. So they had the apnea hypopnea index, which is just an index of, you know, how many times you stop breathing and slow your breathing during the sleep. And so they were looking at the amount of events that happened per hour, which is a typical way to report that. And so under total sleep, under the first night that they were there, under placebo conditions, so just breathing room air, they had 68 apnea hypopnea events within every hour. So this is very disrupted sleep. And then by the third night, they sort of adjust a little bit, and they had 49. But that's still, you know, that's still 50 apnea hypopnea events within an every single hour during your sleep. So we're talking very disrupted sleep at altitude. So what was the effects of the CO2? Well, the CO2 significantly reduces. So within that, there was across both the first and the third nights that they were tested, when the patient or the subjects were given the CO2, the small amounts of CO2 during sleep at the altitude, that apnea hypopnea index reduced down to about 15. So there was a significant reduction in the amount of apneas and hypopneic events that occurred during the sleep. So the CO2 that was piped in significantly improved the periodic breathing during the night. And so they also looked at it and split it up into REM and non-REM, and they looked at the central apnea hypopnea index as well versus obstructive. So the majority of them seemed to be central. Like we said, the periodic breathing at altitude tends to be from central mediation, so changes in loop gain within your ability to react to CO2 and its interaction with oxygen. And so as a result, they were all from central origin versus that of, you can have apneas and hypopneas that are obstructive. So like just to think about the difference there, someone with obstructive sleep apnea, which is the most common kind of sleep apnea, this is when, let's say, the tongue falls back and obstructs your airway. And so this is where the central drive to breathe is still totally fine and there, but your tongue is in the way, so you can't breathe. So you have an obstruction that's causing the lack of breathing or the apnea, versus that of a central apnea. So central sleep apnea is much less common. But in this case, Central sleep apnea is just where your brain does not tell you to breathe anymore. So your brain no longer sends the signal to breathe and you just stop breathing altogether. They also had different indexes for the duration of how long the apneic events and the hypopneic events were. So that was the first table that was presented. They also looked at the, oxygen desaturation index, which is just an index of how many times the oxygen within your blood desaturated below either 3 or 4%. So during these apneic events, during these periodic breathing events, of course, since your breathing is becoming cyclical, the amount of oxygen in your blood also becomes cyclical. And so you can look at how many times the blood oxygen levels desaturated greater than 3 or 4%. And that was, 52 times, it looks like here, about 40 times per hour that your oxygen within your blood was falling more than 3 or 4%. So that's a lot. And of course, when they were given the CO2, since there was less periodic breathing, that didn't happen as much. It only happened roughly, 8 to 10 times per hour. So that's a significant decrease there, which is good. So the mean saturation of oxygen within the subjects under normal conditions was about 76 to 80, which is, under normal conditions, about 98 to 100. But since you're at altitude, that drops because the total amount of oxygen that's actually available for you to breathe is lower. So that's pretty normal there. Okay, and so there was a lot more things that were looked at, the amount of end-tidal CO2, heart rate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So all of the physiology variables were documented within all of the subjects and quite well done. So hats off to the investigators for getting all of that. But here's where it starts to get interesting. What actually happened to the sleep? So we've talked so far about the respiratory parameters, right? And so it seems that when you give subjects a small increase in CO2 throughout the night when they're sleeping at altitude, it significantly reduces the amount of periodic breathing that they have. And of course, like we talked about, periodic breathing seemed to be one of the major things that was contributing to the disruption of sleep quality when at altitude. So you would hypothesize that if you can fix that by increasing the amount of CO2, then you should have better sleep. But that's not what happened. Because anyone that does physiology knows that it can never be that simple. And so, of course, it was never that simple. So it's glad to see that that is also the case here. So they took a look at the total amount of sleep time. So how much the people were sleeping when they were in the hyperbaric chamber, either breathing normal air or CO2. They looked at the sleep efficiency, sleep latency, how long it took you to go to sleep, the REM latency, and then looked at the different stages of sleep, so N1 and 2 and 3, arousal index, all sorts of different indexes for the quality of sleep. And so the major finding, though, from all of them was that the amount of sleep or the sleep quality as a result of the reduced amount of periodic breathing was not changed. And so that's quite fascinating. Why? I don't know. That's sort of an interesting thing. You would think that reduction in the periodic breathing would certainly cause your sleep to be better, but it didn't seem to be the case. And so even though the breathing was fixed, the sleep was not fixed. So, it's still efficacious to fix the periodic breathing because you don't want to be doing these periods where you have saturation, desaturation occurring. You want to try to keep your blood oxygen levels at relatively constant, but doesn't seem to affect sleep. Of course, one of the caveats, I guess, not caveats, one of the things to consider, though, when interpreting the results of these studies is that you are having subjects sleep within a laboratory type of setting, and not only a laboratory setting, but like a hyperbaric chamber type of laboratory setting. And so even though you're looking at the disrupted sleep as a result of the hyperbaric chamber, that placebo sleep, when they're in the hyperbaric chamber breathing the normal air, at 4,000 meters, you know, that's that in and of itself, you're going to have disrupted sleep from that. But within, intermixed within the sleep disruptions that occur from that are also sleep disruptions as a result of sleeping in the lab. And so a nice control would have been to do essentially to compare it to the normal sleep of that person without the laboratory setting, if that makes sense. And so that's one of those things that, you know, you can't really ask to do. I guess you could ask to do. You can ask people to do whatever. But realistically, it's a hard one to kind of control for. So essentially, the disrupted sleep could be a result of the high altitude, which it certainly is, but there also could be sleep disruptions from just sleeping in the box. You know what I mean? And so those are going to be carried over from the placebo to the CO2. And so it is designed, of course, the study is designed that that's normalized out, because in both the CO2 and under the placebo conditions, they're sleeping in the same box. And so you're isolating the effects of the altitude itself, or you're isolating the effects of the periodic breathing, rather. But like I said, there's going to be multiple variables that are contributing to quality of sleep, especially within a laboratory setting. And so, you know, whether or not the reducing the periodic breathing effect on sleep is the same within this lab setting as it is within the top of the mountain is hard to tell. So that would have to actually be tested. But nonetheless, adding a little bit of CO2 reduces the periodic breathing, which is a good thing, but it doesn't seem to improve the quality of sleep. I may have butchered that explanation, but hopefully you're following the same train of thought. You get the idea. So that was the study. Great study. Journal of Physiology. You should look it up. If not, then hopefully you enjoyed it here. Now, I wanted to just sort of finish here. There's some things that are, you know, have come up. Of course, the question is, why would you give someone CO2 in order to change the periodic breathing when, in fact, you're looking at one of the main problems is this saturation, desaturation of oxygen? You might assume that more oxygen is always better. So why don't they just give them oxygen? So it might seem logical to assume that you can just give them oxygen and everything is better. And of course, well, supplemental oxygen can indeed alleviate symptoms of altitude sickness and improve quality of sleep to some extent. It's certainly not a cure-all. So overuse of oxygen can actually dampen the body's natural acclimatization process, potentially prolonging the adjustment period to high altitude. So moderation there is certainly key, as with anything. And of course, just for a little fun fact, record-breaking sleep studies. Did you know that one of the highest sleep studies ever conducted took place at Mount Everest's Camp 3, which is over 7,000 meters above sea levels? Researchers studying the effects of extreme altitude on the human body found that sleep at this height was profoundly fragmented because you're at Mount Everest's Camp 3. So participants experienced severe reductions in both REM and slow wave sleep, which of course are crucial for cognitive function and physical recovery. So don't sleep at Mount Everest Camp 3 too much, or you may get dumber. Another interesting tidbit, in 1981, a team of intrepid scientists and climbers conducted a series of studies on Mount Everest that included taking polysomnographic recordings at altitudes surpassing 6,000 meters. The study revealed that significant nighttime oxygen desaturation, periodic breathing, and notable decreases in sleep efficiency at this were also challenges that the human body faces at these extreme environments. So that's pretty interesting. There you go. Now you have it. All right, so let's wrap this puppy up. So we talked about some high altitude, sleeping at high altitude, why it's difficult, and an innovative way that these researchers have come up with to at least tackle the effects of periodic breathing during altitude. So next time you decide to go climbing up into the clouds, up into the high altitude of the mountains, yeah, who knows? Bring a little bit of CO2 with you. You know, don't give too much because it's got to be highly controlled. So ideally, you would bring a graduate student or a tech up with you that would be able to sit throughout the entire night and monitor the amount of CO2 to keep it right at level to maintain the non-periodicity of breathing. So I'm not sure how you're going to do that, but maybe get up a backpack or something. I don't know. Graduate students like food. You could try that too. All right. So thanks for sticking around. And we'll see you in the next episode. Okay, bye.